We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers the 50s and 60s.
Today, Ronnie remembers Sissy from Family Affair.
Oh, Sissy, they're playing your song. Right now, it's my pleasure to introduce the lady who played Sissy in every one of the episodes of that very popular, beloved sitcom called Family Affair. Ladies and gentlemen, here she is. Welcome to the show, Kathy Garver. How are you, Kathy?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am fine. There is just so much to talk about. Wow, what was that?
That's the dog.
Oh, the dog.
That's the Cocker Spaniel protecting the house.
You know, I have this thing when I do interviews, like I interviewed Jimmy Rogers, and he had his dogs, and I was going to start the interview. I said, here he is, Jimmy Rogers, and then I go, wah, 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 and he says, Ronnie, could you wait a few moments before I got to do something with these dogs? I don't know, I must attract the dogs.
I guess that's what it is.
I think so. Kathy, we're going to talk about the thing that you are best known for, but unlike most interviews, what I generally do is I cover that like at the very beginning, and then I say, well, we're going to also just talk briefly now about some other things you've done. I'm going to do it in reverse today. I'm going to talk about the other things you've done first, and then the rest of the show will be about something called Family Affair.
Does that sound? I can handle that.
You have such an incredible career. In addition, if you had never done Family Affair but did all these other things that you've done, that would be a very complete career because you have done voiceovers, you've done TV, of course, you've done films, you've done stage, you've just done it all. You even wrote a book, which we're going to talk about.
Now I've got to write my second one now.
Oh, you mean there's going to be part two? You left out some of the recipes?
This is cooking up a recipe to survive Sissy.
Oh, to survive Sissy. This is going to just be so much fun for me, and I just want to say in advance, thank you so very much for agreeing to do this. We originally met back in 2003 at an event called the Friends of Old Time Radio.
The best part of that was you playing the piano and me singing off key.
Oh, you don't sing off. You're being unkind to yourself. You didn't sing off key, but you certainly knew all those Tom Lehrer songs that I was playing.
Ah, yes.
We're big Tom Lehrer fans, ladies and gentlemen. That's a little secret about Kathy. I bet you didn't know that she's a big fan of Tom Lehrer, who is a satirist.
And it's a secret no longer.
No, it's a secret no longer. Kathy, just tell me a little bit about where you were born and raised and where you're presently living.
I'm a California girl, always have been, and I still am. But I have kind of moved up the coast as I was born in Southern California in Long Beach and then moved to Sherman Oaks and Beverly Hills and Palm Springs, and now I am in Northern California, and I went to Portola Valley, then Woodside, then Hillsboro. I keep moving up the coast. I guess my next stop is, well, I'm going to stay in California, Redmond, but probably Oregon.
Oh, I see. Wow. I think you need a scorecard to keep track of where you've been.
I've been in each of these places for a very long time. I've been in my present home for 28 years.
Well, let's see. You've done TV, you've done voiceovers, character actress, stage. Of course, we know what you're most known for, but we're going to get to that later in the show. That's going to be our closing act today, talking about the biggest thing in your life. But I have to tell you, years ago, I used to watch a TV show called Panic, and I think you know where I'm going with this. This was before Twilight Zone. It wasn't actually so much like a Twilight Zone show. It was kind of a show about people in very difficult situations, a moment of panic. Westbrook Van Voorhis was the announcer for the show, And the show, I think, ran a couple of seasons, and in the second season, they changed the name to No Warning, but it was the same show. You were in an episode of Panic.
And I remember to this day, even though I was probably only around 10 years old when I did that show, the interview. I was supposed to run in and then drop my books and scream. And so I said, now, do you really want me to scream? Or do you want me to be a quiet scream or a loud scream? And they said, no, scream. I said, okay. So I ran into the room and screamed at the top of my lungs. And I got the job.
Wow.
A very loud scream. I was the voice of the devil and the heretic. It was like the same thing. I mean, I really reached down into my evil twin's lowest vocal range and really put on this. I started with a scream and then went to the very bad.
Wow. You are good. Maybe I should say, you are bad. At any rate, I just remembered now, that Panic episode was called Mayday, and it was about a ham radio operator trapped in his burning home. Very exciting episode.
Wonderful. Now, a lot of these classic shows, there is a new network called MeTV,
right.
Memorable Entertainment,
yes.
And it's launching December 8th, 2010, and it will be playing some of the classic television shows, Family Affair being one of them. It's nice to see that these fabulous shows that were done on film and had such great scripts are getting replayed.
That's fantastic. I'm hoping that they eventually release a DVD set of the Panic and No Warning shows, because I was mesmerized watching those shows, and you were part of one of them. Another thing that mesmerized me was a film which starred Patty McCormick as the Bad Seed. You were in that, too.
I was in that, and we taped my scenes at Griffith Park, and Shelley Fabre was also in that movie.
I didn't know that. She was
in
the band.
Yeah, we were shaking our fingers at, you know, at Patty, saying, oh, we know you're responsible in some way for this.
Patty, by the way, played a character named Rhoda.
Yes, Rhoda Penmark.
Rhoda Penmark, that's right.
And there was a remake of it.
I understand that there was a remake. I remember the original. You played one of Rhoda's classmates?
That's correct, yes.
The name of the teacher was Mrs. Fern.
Yes, and I'm trying to remember now the name of the director.
Mervyn LeRoy, maybe?
Yes, Mervyn LeRoy, okay. That's who I'm thinking of, yes.
It was kind of confusing to me because Mervyn LeRoy was the director, and there was a character played by this guy, I think his last name was Jones, but he played this character LeRoy. He was the handyman.
Yes, that's right.
She actually ended up murdering him.
Yes, that was a real bad seed.
Oh, my gosh. At the very end of the movie, they did something that is very seldom done. Certainly, I don't recall it ever being done before, like in a dramatic movie. At the very end of the movie, after the end, it said basically, stick around because we have this special ending here. And they introduced the cast. And everybody, like, took their little bows, including Patty McCormick. It ended up with, was it Nancy Kelly that played the mom, I believe?
Yes.
I think it was Nancy Kelly. And she ended up, like, spanking little Patty as Rhoda. And that was the end. But I understand that they did that because the film was so disturbing that they wanted to remind people, hey, you know, it's a disturbing film, but it's just a film.
Right. Well, I think that's probably the rationale. And also, you know, like on stage plays, the cast always comes out and takes a bow. I think that's kind of nice to, you know, as you say, remind them, well, this isn't, you know, real life.
What was Patty McCormick like, though, when she was filming that, dude? Did you spend a lot of time with Patty?
Oh, she was terrific. And she and her stand-in and all the kids, and we rode the bus together, and I've seen her lately. She's still just as warm, and I mean, she's really a
warm person. I mean, Patty was not Rhoda. We want to point that out.
Yes, you know, it shows what an excellent actress she is.
Kathy, you had a role in the Ten Commandments?
Yes, that was one of my very first roles, and I was actually just hired as an extra, not to say anything, and there were many extras that were obviously hired for the mm-hmm. Ten Commandments, and my part was to ride in a rickety wagon through the streets right before the Exodus part.
Right.
So I had gotten all this makeup on, this body makeup, very cold sponge, and homespun garments, and I had been given a lamb to carry in my lap. And so then I was placed up in the wagon, and Cecil B. DeMille, or some great big voice, because, it came from the clouds, it seemed, or way up in the sky, said, action. And then he says, cut. He said, don't let that little girl's face get in the camera.
Why?
What did I do?
What did you do?
Well, I thought I was just doing what I was supposed to be doing. But the assistant director came over, put a little blanket over my head, and we continued with the scene. Afterwards, this great big voice came down, and it was Cecil B. DeMille, and we chatted. And so he wrote scenes for me in the Ten Commandments, talking scenes, principal scenes, with Charlton Heston. And, you know, I later found out, I think that's one of the reasons that made Cecil B. DeMille so great and his movie so accessible. It was not only the fabulous epic movie and the wonderful special effects that they had, but he put in human touches. And these are, you know, throughout the movie. And for, like, my first scene, I'm coming down through the Exodus, and I said, oh, where's the pumpkin? And Grandfather says, here's the pumpkin. I said, oh, where's Rebecca? And they said, here's Rebecca, and she was a little doll, a homemade doll. And then I go down and try and get some water. Then the next scene I have with him is when the Red Sea is closing, and he comes up to me on the papier-mâché mountain. I'm all by myself, and he says, are you afraid? And then I stick out my doll, and I say, no, but Rebecca is. And we cut, and he takes me off the house. So, you know, with Cecil B. DeMille weaving these human stories and human characters into the epic film. And I was one of those human knight characters that was woven into the film.
That had to be a humbling experience working for one of the greatest producer-directors of all time.
As a child, you don't know. I mean, I didn't know he was such a great director. I just knew that this was this great big man that came down from a crane.
Yeah.
And just the shooting of the movie itself was so spectacular. I mean, my part alone, I was on there for like 6 weeks.
Wow.
Because they held me over for like 3 weeks, kept paying.
That's good.
Yeah, and it was the animals and the kids. We would go down to where they kept the menagerie of camels and sheep, and we'd play with them, and it was just obviously unforgettable.
I'm sure it was. Now, how long are you actually on the screen with your speaking roles?
I'm on about three times.
What was your name in the movie?
Rachel. Okay. Rachel the Slave Girl.
Rachel the Slave Girl. So when do we see Rachel? Toward the end of the movie?
Right at the beginning of the Exodus and as the Red Sea is closing.
And as the Red Sea is closing. That must have been a difficult thing to have the Red Sea part. I mean, I guess he looked up in the heavens, okay, make the Red Sea part for this movie.
Well, it was pretty cool because they had built these papier-mâché mountains at Paramount Studios. And then on the catwalks, where all the lights were, that's where they place these great big buckets of water. So they could actually get, you know, the expressions of the people when the water descended.
Oh, I see.
I have a story about that, but it's a little bit too long.
We'll save that for part two of our interview.
Right.
The bottom line is the Red Sea really didn't part. It was a special effect, actually.
Yes.
Anyway, I am Ronnie Allen talking with Kathy Garver, and between the mid-50s and the mid-60s, you worked with many different actors, and I'm just going to rattle off a few that I have here. You can tell me if they're all correct. Not in any particular order. Marvin Miller, Chuck Connors, Peter Graves, Scott Forbes, Dan O'Herlihy, Kurt Russell, Fess Parker, Vince Edwards, Richard Chamberlain, Patty Duke, Ann Lockhart, James Franciscus, and Ronnie Allen. Well, not Ronnie Allen.
June Lockhart.
June Lockhart, too.
Lockhart, which I did, as well as June. We were all in the Death Valley Days episode together.
What we've discussed is what you did before Family Affair. And, of course, we, you know, we can't cover everything. I do want to recommend, if you want to learn a bit more about Kathy Garver, visit Kathy's website, which is, let me guess, www.kathygarver.com.
You must be pathetic.
Oh,
yes,
I am.
Exactly.
Well,
right.
Some people say I'm pathetic.
I say prophetic.
But I'll go for prophetic. That's fine. Also, the IMDb, which stands for Internet Movie Database, has a zillion credits that you you have.
I've been in this business forever.
It seems like, well, you know, actually, you've been in this business for two or three forevers, to tell you the truth. It's just pretty incredible. Well, we're going to talk about what happened after Family Affair, and then, of course, we're going to get to the meat and potatoes and much, much more of what this interview is about. You were the voice of Alice Mitchell in the Dennis the Menace cartoon special?
Yes, I was.
Another May Day thing, May Day for Mothers.
I'm in for help whenever possible. Yes, May Day for Mothers.
May Day for Mothers, is it? Is it plural, Mothers?
I think, yeah.
Okay, this is from Wikipedia, so this could be wrong. It says May Day for Mother, but Mothers, what's the difference? Six of one, half dozen of another.
One's one and one's three.
One's one, yeah, actually. You've done a lot of different voice roles, including the TV series, Fonz and the Happy Day Gang, the Tom and Jerry Kids Show, Droopy, Master Detective, the New Yogi Bear Show, as opposed to the old one, I guess, the Richie Rich Scooby-Doo Show, and let's see, there's a few others here.
One that I'm most kind of famous for is I created the role of Firestar and Angelica Jones on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, which is still running on ABC Family Channel.
Yes, it does say that here.
That was a really good series. I loved doing, well, I like playing a superhero.
Oh, well.
But, yeah, that was really a fun series to do and great scripts.
You also were on a short-lived but still popular show called The Bing Crosby Show in 64 and 65. In the 1990s Spider-Man cartoon series, you played the voice of Miss America?
Yes.
You know, I look at this, and I said to myself, I better ask Kathy if all this is true, because no person could have done all this.
It is all true, and that's a wonderful thing about voiceovers. Not only does it take just a little bit of time, and then the animators do the rest, but you can play any type of character. I can go from Miss America to an evil character like Enya in the anime JoJo's Bizarre Adventures. And I can play little kids, and I can play sexy women. And, you know, it's really fabulous. As I say, it doesn't take as much time as actually shooting something like that.
You're amazing that you could do it. I bet you could have probably played the bad seed, too. You probably could have played Rhoda.
Oh, I could indeed.
And she was evil.
Evil incarnate.
You have also, as if that isn't enough, you've done voices for many commercials, toys, and audiobooks. You produced, narrated, and wrote lyrics and composed the music for about 8 audio Beatrix Potter tales.
Yes.
And 8 Mother Goose-based audio tapes for Smarty Pants.
We're just getting ready to release those, make them downloadable. Because when we originally did them, they were on cassettes. And so we're in the process of putting them online.
That's fantastic.
I mean, these are fabulous things, like classics, that never go out of style, like Family Affair.
There's something
about them that withstand the test of time, like Beatrix Potter and Mother Goose Tales. And there's no reason why a whole new generation of children can't enjoy them.
You also sold about 2 million copies of the Beatrix Potter tapes.
And now we're going to download 2 million more.
2 million more? Absolutely. Actually, as we're talking right now, you're probably selling at least 100 more copies somewhere. While we're doing this interview. You also won a couple of Audie Awards. What does that mean, the Audie Awards?
An Audie is like the Oscar for the spoken word. Oh, I have another short story. Do we have time for
Yeah, absolutely. I have as much time as you want. I got 10 hours here.
I was just going to say, besides narrating, I also direct, and I directed Amy Tan in one of her books. Now, Amy, you may know, is a very successful author of The Joy Luck Club, and she wrote the book Opposite of Fate. And so she read the book, and I directed her in reading it, and we were nominated and then won the Audie Award. So I called her up, and I said, Amy, isn't this great? We won the Audie. And she said, well, yeah, but when they first called, I thought I'd won a car. So not an Audi car, but an AUDIE.
AUDIE. Well, the important thing is the idea. That's the most important thing. Also, you were in the movie, at least your voice was heard in the movie Apollo 13.
Ah, yes, and that won an Academy Award for sound.
Exactly what it says here. You probably wrote this article here. It says it won the Academy Award for sound. Yes, it did.
Yeah, we did.
You were in Ransom, Backdraft, and Jingle All the Way.
Ah, yes, with the Governator.
And directed by Ron Howard?
Yes, from Happy Days. So our relationship goes back a long way.
And finally, before we get to An Orphan Reindeer, we're going to talk about, and then we're going to, of course, have the final act of this show. Do you remember the Pi Beta Phi Fraternity for Women? I have trouble saying that. Pi Beta Phi.
Pi Beta Phi, P-I-P-H-I-Pi-Pi. Me for Pi for Beta, Phi for I just love Pi Beta Phi. We really inculcate you into that.
Don't ask me to sing that.
Okay.
It wouldn't be pretty. Are you still living in Hillsboro, California now? Or did
mm-hmm.
you? Okay. And your husband's name is David?
Mm-hmm.
And you have a son named Reed?
Yes.
And finally, and of course we're going to be talking about Brian Keith at length in the next few moments, on June 26, 2008, you attended the Hollywood Walk of Fame ceremony. He was awarded posthumously a star, and you gave a speech.
I did.
On his behalf. That covers the Kathy Garver story minus family affair, with one exception, and we're going to do the exception now, and then we're going to talk about family affair. You recorded at some point in your illustrious career a song called Lem, the Orphan Reindeer, and you were nice enough to send it to me. What could you tell me about Lem, the Orphan Reindeer?
Well, I was one of the first artists signed to Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart Aquarian Records. And last week, I got an email from this fellow that is doing a biography on Tommy and Bobby, the later part of their career. As I say, I was like one of the very first artists that was signed. Well, maybe that's why it went down in the dust. But Tommy and Bobby wrote this song for me, and Chuck Ashman, who put together Aquarian Records, said, well, if Rudolph could do it, I guess Lem could do it. And at that time, there was a lot of space exploration. So this was like, I forget what they call it, but a lunar exterior module, Lem was. And so it was this reindeer that was flying around. So the story on that is, and you'll hear it in this, I do believe it was the first rap song, although you corrected me and said, no, there was a rap song before this.
I think I may have mentioned Pink Shoelaces by Dodie Stevens, where she was like about 12 when she recorded it, and she was like, you know, I got a guy, and his name is Dooley. You know.
But then she sang it.
Yeah, but then she sang tan shoes and pink shoelaces.
Shoelaces, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I started to sing my song in the very midst of nowhere, Santa hollered, whoa! And they said, whoa. The sound engineer says, would you sing that again? I sang that lyric again. They said, you know, you're a little flat. I said, would you mind just saying these lyrics? And I said, sure, okay. So I rapped the lyric, in the very midst of nowhere, Santa hollered, whoa!
Now, Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, of course, had a lot of music credits. Tommy is no longer around. Bobby still is, and they did thing for the Monkees, and they had recordings on their own, and they wrote this song especially for you, huh? How did they feel about your rapping?
They liked it. It actually sold a lot of copies.
What year did it come out in?
It was probably 1970, I think.
You were still working on Family Affair?
Yes.
We're going to take a listen to it right now. Believe it or not, this is Kathy Garver and...
In the very midst of nowhere, Santa signaled, whoa. He'd spied a tiny reindeer struggling in the snow. As Santa raced to help him, he shouted and he waved.
And the little reindeer cried with joy, knowing he was saved. I'm Lem, the orphan reindeer.
I was nearly dead. I'm tired and cold and hungry, the little fellow said. I lost my folks this morning, and tonight I lost my way.
But for Lem, the orphan reindeer, it's still a lucky day. Lem, the orphan reindeer.
Lem, the orphan reindeer, Oh, Santa said aloud. You're joining Santa's family. I know you'll make us proud. You'll grow so big and strong and fast. You'll join my mighty team. You'll race to Mars and then the stars. Now go to sleep and dream. All snug in Santa's woolly rug, the baby reindeer lay, shivering with such happy thoughts, as Santa raced his sleigh. I'll find a way, I will repay, tiny fellow play. Lem's wish. My command.
Now Lem, the orphan reindeer,
is what Santa said he'd be. Member of a mighty team. And a wondrous sight to see. So tall and strong, with legs so long, they fairly leaped to Mars. And Santa's pride was a high. His land has reached stars.
Kathy, what's an orphan?
That was Kathy Garver and Lem, the orphan reindeer. I am Ronnie Allen, and I am talking to a lady with an absolutely incredible career, and we have just barely scratched the surface, because no matter what you do the rest of your life, you will always be best known for a TV show called Family Affair. And to get people in the mood, let's hear once again the Family Affair theme song. Familiar theme song from Family Affair. Frank Duvall, I think. I don't know if he composed it or he conducted it. What was Frank Duvall's connection with that?
He was a composer. He was a fabulous composer. And yes, I will be known for Family Affair for so long. That's why my second book is entitled Surviving Sissy.
There were 138 episodes. The first episode was called Buffy.
Johnny and I came in at the very end. I was in every single episode.
Okay, you answered my next question. How many were you in?
138.
138. And if there was 139, you would have been in 139, too.
That's what my contract called for, every episode.
You never missed an episode. Was Brian in every episode?
Yes.
Anissa Jones, who played Buffy.
That's right. We were all in every episode, the core.
Johnny Whitaker was in every episode.
Yes.
He played Jody.
Right.
One of the twins. And the only person that was not in every episode, I understand, due to some health reasons, was Sebastian Cabot, who played the gentleman's gentleman, Mr. French.
That's correct. And he was replaced for a while by John Williams, who I really loved. John Williams played Sabrina's father in the movie Sabrina, Audrey Hepburn. And I loved that movie. They did a remake of that movie as well, but he was just fabulous.
Wow.
Excellent actor.
Sebastian, what was the problem with his
well, a couple things. One, he had hurt his hand, and he was in the hospital for a while. So that was primarily it. But he got well very quickly.
But he had to miss a few episodes, so you brought in John Williams?
Yes,
okay,
and that
now,
was supposedly his brother.
Sebastian Cabot was Giles French?
Yes.
And his brother was Niles French?
Yes, Giles and Niles, but they weren't twins.
Sebastian is the only one that wasn't in every episode. Now, we're going to talk about Anissa Jones, but before we talk about her in another context, at one point, Anissa broke her leg.
She lived down at the beach in Venice, in Playa del Rey, right by the ocean and the water, and so she went in one time, and then she broke her leg. So we shot Family Affair in a very different kind of way. And this was the innovative genius of Don Federson, who was the producer. At that time, television was, you know, kind of the sorry sister to motion pictures, which
right.
was a big deal. When Don Federson started to do, he had already done Liberace, and I had appeared when I was a child in one of his other series called The Millionaire. Don Federson wanted movie stars to be the star of his television series, but it was difficult to get them. So he made a plan for Fred McMurray for My Three Sons. And so he offered Fred, he says, look, Fred, you come and do this series. Not only do you only have to work for 2 months out of the year, we'll give you a part of the show. Well, actors had never been offered a part of the show. I mean, they just got paid their salary and, you know, adios. So this was the proverbial offer. It worked so well, and My Three Sons was a very big success, that when he was going to do Family Affair, he went after Glenn Ford. Mm-hmm. He was the first one offered the part, but Glenn didn't want to do it. And so Brian said, okay, I'll do it. And so Brian only worked for a couple months and also owned part of the show, as did Sebastian. So the way that we would shoot these shows, the first couple months, we would shoot all the scenes that Brian was in,
uh-huh.
and then he was free to go. So we'd be shooting episodes from four different shows in one day, which also meant that all the scripts had to be finished, and we were at that time 36, 38 scripts at the very beginning of the shooting schedule. Coming back to Anissa, here Anissa breaks her leg. Well, the scriptwriters had certainly not written into the scripts, Anissa breaks her leg. So they had to go back and revamp and put her behind couches and find some way. And then they'd already shot some scenes with Brian where she's walking from one room to the next. Well, she can't then appear with a broken leg walking from one place to the next. And then the third scene, she doesn't have a broken leg. They fixed it, though. They had a stand-in for her, and they rewrote some of the scenes. But, you know, there's nothing so constant as change.
My gosh. And a lot of the change, of course, is unexpected. I would assume if you break your leg, though, you're in a lot of pain. How is Anissa able to do these scenes and not express pain?
Well, you're only in pain when you break your leg.
Oh, okay. I'm glad you straightened me out of that.
I broke my leg, and I was, yes, in, you know, unbelievable pain. But once you go to surgery and get the cast on, then you're fine.
Oh, okay. So this was like all in a day's work. I break my leg. Now I'm fine. Now I go back to the shooting and everything.
The show must go on, Ronnie.
Did this happen during the first season?
No, I think this was probably during the third one.
Now, you mentioned about Brian's scenes being all filmed together.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult as an actress was it for you, particularly when you're doing like four different episodes which are not necessarily connected to one another? How is it possible for you to constantly stay in character and focus and have the proper emotional, whatever the word is I'm looking for, in other words, to make it seem real? It seems to me, just as a non-actor, that it would be a kind of a disjointed experience for you.
Well, it is, absolutely. And not only that, because I was kind of the workhorse of the
yes.
group, I was 18, and the kids were underage, and so they could only work 8 hours. Brian had this incredible deal, and Sebastian's health was not always good. So guess who was the stalwart of the show? And I would maybe do the master scene at the beginning of the day with maybe the kids, and then they go home at 5 o'clock because they can't work any longer. And now here's Kathy, who can work until 7, 8. And so then we pick up my close-ups. To me, that took more concentration and focus than from going to show to show. Because a film show is never filmed sequentially.
Yeah.
It's more filmed as where the location is.
I see. So
you're going to film all the shots you can at the park. And now we're going to film all the shots we can in the living room.
I see.
So you'll get used to that part.
I see. And
the concentration of it. And once your character is established, it's just different lines or, you know, different things to be doing.
Still, I think it takes a certain amount of innate ability to be able to do it. Of course, obviously, you and the others were able to do this and did it so seamlessly. You know, everything just seemed so credible and nobody was aware. In fact, nobody's aware when they watch a movie, of course. You could end up doing the very closing scene of the movie first and then nobody really knows the difference unless the information comes out on Google or YouTube or whatever.
That's right, Ronnie. That's why we get paid the big bucks.
And part of those big bucks, incidentally, were merchandising. You as Sissy were merchandised like crazy. I think there were paper dolls, right?
Well, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s was the first time that they got into merchandising shows.
Okay, so if you...
They didn't merchandise them before. Disney did, but not like sitcoms or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, I think, started over at Fox with the merchandising. And that became a big moneymaker for these producers.
Right.
Sometimes, I mean, Disney makes more now on these ancillary products than the actual product itself or the movie. So, yes, we started, and then there were Family Affair lunch boxes and coloring books and Mrs. Beasley dolls. And
uh-huh.
Yeah, so that really got into one of the first eras of merchandising. And, you know, merchandising is still going out. As you know, I have my Family Affair cookbook.
Right, yes. In fact, give me one recipe. I'll let you just pick it out because I want to play a little sample of the talking version of your cookbook. It's on a CD.
Yes.
Give me one recipe that I could use as a for instance, and I could play a few seconds of it for our audience.
Well, that's a good idea. Sissy's coconut cookies.
Sissy's, okay, that's it's easier to play than for me to say it. Sissy's coconut cookies. Sissy's coconut cookies.
I'm really big into alliteration. I teach speech and diction.
Oh, okay.
And I majored in speech at UCLA, so I should be able to do, you know, like Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers quickly, because
okay.
I have to set a good example.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. If Moses
supposes,
that was good. That was not bad.
He thrusts this against the post and still insists he sees the ghost.
Danny Kaye did a great record called Tongue Twisters, and I wouldn't even start, hello, dog, is something I said? I upset your dog.
She doesn't like tongue twisters. She can't say them.
Any rate, from the Family Affair cookbook, here's Kathy Garver and Sissy's Coconut Cookies. I said it and I'm glad.
Sissy's Coconut Cookies. I'm no fool. These go great with Buffy's chocolate pudding. Ingredients for coconut cookies. 2/3 cup of butter, softened. 1 egg. 1/2 teaspoon vanilla extract. 1/2 cup packed light brown sugar. 1 cup shredded coconut. 2/3 cup rolled oats. 1 cup self-rising flour. 2 cups cornflakes, lightly crushed. Preheat oven to 325 degrees. Grease 2 baking sheets. Put butter, egg, vanilla, and sugar in a medium mixing bowl and beat until creamy. Stir in coconut, oats, and flour and mix to form dough. Roll dough with your clean hands into about 24 balls, each one approximately about the size of a walnut. Put crushed cornflakes on a plate. Lightly press dough balls in cornflakes to coat. Place on baking sheets. Bake about 15 minutes until lightly browned. Transfer to a wire rack to cool.
Well, that's a nice recipe indeed. I'm Ronnie Allen talking with Kathy Garver, a.k.a. Sissy, on Family Affair. And before we discuss what the premise of the show was, I understand your mom did something to help you get the role. Did she did something with your hair or something? You sprayed it or something?
Yes, I love my mom. I was just starting UCLA, and I was at the sorority, the Pi Phi House, and they were looking for an older sister. Now, they had already cast Brian Sebastian, Anissa, and Johnny in the role. And they were all very fair, blonde hair, blue eyes, although Anissa had brown eyes. And so they were looking for a blonde-haired girl. Well, at that time, they had dark hair and dark eyes. And so my mother, ever inventive, came over to the sorority house. He says, I have the solution. So she sprayed my hair with this stuff called Streaks and Tips. Well, I emerge looking like something out of Goldfinger. I dutifully, she takes me over to meet the producer, and I'm talking to lovely Mr. Hartman, and we're chatting, and he says, what's the matter with your hair? I said, my hair? And he says, yeah, it's turning green. Oh, well, I was at a loss for words at that point. I think I recovered saying, oh, you're not doing a remake of The Girl with Green Hair?
No.
No. So anyway, he thought that my personality was good enough to do a screen test. So then I went to Max Factor in Hollywood, had this long blonde wig. Then I emerged looking like something out of Alice in Wonderland with a blue check dress. So I'm back at the sorority, and my mother calls. She says, you got it. Only they say, never wear that wig again and never wear that dress.
Oh, gee.
And I didn't.
But you got the role.
I got the role in 138 episodes.
How soon did they let you know that you got the role after you did your testing for it?
I did my screen test as they were shooting the pilot.
Oh, wow.
I actually did, with that long blonde wig and blue dress, they had already started filming.
Did they tell you immediately you're going to be it? You're going to.
They
be...
told me within 3 days.
Within 3 days. That's.
I mean, after, you know, they gave it to my agent. My agent worked out the deal, and they said yes.
the premise of the show was steeped in tragedy, really.
Well, yes, it was. I think this was kind of one of the first dramedies on television and probably one of the first dysfunctional families. It was based, though, on a situational comedy where the humor came from the situation rather than quick jokes or pratfalls.
Right.
And the premise was a freewheeling bachelor lived in a beautiful penthouse apartment in New York with his man's man, his valet, his nanny, we would say. And one day, there's a knock on his door, and one of his nieces is delivered, and then his other niece and nephew, because our parents, Buffy, Jody, and Sissy's parents, had died in a car accident. And so that was the premise. It was interesting because they thought at the beginning this was going to be more of an adult show.
Right.
And it was started at 9:30,
mm-hmm.
which was later for kids.
Yes.
Because they were going to see, well, how does this, you know, very handsome bachelor that's dating all the time
mm-hmm.
deal with these three kids that are going to be in the background? But then the kids kind of took over, and it changed the complexion of the shows and the stories a little.
The lead character was Uncle Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, his full name was William Davis, originally of Terre Haute, Indiana.
And so Brian, for the first 2 years, would say Terre Haute.
Of Terre Haute. Well,
oh, Uncle Bill, can we go to Terre Haute? Yes, I'll see if I can take you to Terre Haute.
Maybe that's the right way. I don't know. I always said Terre Haute.
It's supposed to be Terre Haute, but Brian would always say, my uncle's from Terre Haute, and I'm going to say Terre Haute.
Well,
you say Terre Haute, the kids are going to say Terre Haute.
Yeah. And his character, he was a successful civil engineer. He developed major projects throughout the world. He was a wealthy bachelor, dating girls, lived in a Park Avenue apartment in Manhattan.
Right.
And, of course, the quintessential gentleman's gentleman, Mr. Giles French, played so well by Sebastian Cabot. There are some people, you say family affair, oh, that's the one with Mr. French. Even if they don't know his name, Sebastian, they'll say, isn't that the one with Mr. French?
Yes, and he was such a character. I see now, you know, looking back, that what, too, establishes characters in people's mind is the consistency of their character and their wardrobe. Now, Sebastian Cabot wore the very same thing. So he's readily identified. Buffy never changed her hairstyle. So that established her, you know, very much as that particular character, and the same with Johnny. I was constantly changing my clothes, changing the heights of my skirt, changing my hair, you know, so I became more of the ephemeral character.
I guess. You were the only one that changed a lot.
I was the only one that changed.
Now, we're going to play a little clip. This was the second episode. The first one was really the pilot episode, wasn't it? The one that was called Buffy?
Well, yeah, the first is the pilot where I just come at the end, and then the second one, Jody and Sissy, where they're more introduced, my character and Johnny's character.
Yeah, and we're going to play a scene. Now, Uncle Bill is actually overseas. I believe he was in Peru at the time when he found out over the phone that you had moved in.
Right.
The episode is called Jody and Sissy. We're going to play a little bit of that episode right now with Kathy Garver as Sissy. And by the way, all five principal characters are heard in this particular portion.
Hi.
Hi, Uncle Bill.
Hi, Buffy. You miss me?
Yes, but Miss Beezy is my really and truly friend. So whenever I cried at night, she would say, there, there, Buffy. Say hello to Jody.
Hi, Jody.
And Sissy?
Sissy? It's been a long time.
Sure has. It's wonderful to see you again, Uncle Bill.
I didn't know you were here when I called.
I realized that.
Oh, excuse me, sir. First you'll want to rest after your long journey.
Have I still got a bedroom?
Oh, quite, sir, quite. I activated the guest room for Buffy and Sissy. Master Jody has been sleeping in your room, sir, but I've moved him into the den.
Uncle Bill, I don't like the den. I'm scared of tigers.
Huh? Oh, well, that's not a real tiger, Jody. That's just a head mounted on the wall. You know, stuffed. He can't hurt you. I shot him in Bengal.
What did you do with the rest of it?
Nothing. I just brought home his head.
If I did that, I'd get spanked.
Oh. Well, look, kids. I am exhausted, and I haven't had much sleep, so I'm going to bed. Now, good night.
Good night.
Now that I'm home, we'll have plenty of time together, okay?
Good night. Okay. Good night. You see, Sissy, he likes kids.
I hope he likes me.
There you are, Jody. Real llama.
Will they bite? No, that's his hairy shoe.
And there's yours, Buffy. Oh, here, Fitzy. That's for you. I figured a pretty girl could always use another one of those things.
It's beautiful.
Good to see you again, Sissy.
Uncle Bill, I know you weren't expecting me to move in on you like this.
Now, don't you worry about that. Look, I have to go to the office early tomorrow. Now, why don't you come down about noon, and then we can have lunch and we'll talk, okay?
Fine. And whatever you decide to do, I'll understand.
Boy, does that bring back memories. That was episode number 2. And the interesting thing about that, there's two things about that episode. Number one, part of that episode was Mr. French is leaving for good.
Yes.
And number 2, Sissy is leaving for good. Oh, I'm not going to stay here after all. I'm going to go back, you know. If those two things had happened, there would not have been another 136 episodes. Certainly not with you. Not with him. So
But the ratings were too good.
Yeah.
I said, oh, okay, we'll stay.
Well, I think that people watching that episode probably said, oh, this is, you know, we're not going to lose Mr. French that quick. We're not going to lose Sissy that quick. So
yeah, we know what's going to really happen.
We know what's going to really happen. But part of the fun watching episodes is not only figuring out what's going to happen, but then watching it get to that point. That was always the thing with The Honeymooners, which was a totally different type of a show, actually. But The Honeymooners with Gleason is often you knew what was going to happen. You knew that Cramden was going to explode. You knew Norton was going to act dumb. But it was like, how are we going to get there? Part of the enjoyment of watching sitcoms is even if you know what's going to happen, just watching it happen.
Well, that's right, and it keeps the tension up.
Yes.
You know, nothing is good like in a story unless there's a certain amount of tension.
Absolutely.
So that added to it, I believe.
We're going to move to another episode now, and this was, I think it might have been midway through the first season. It's another one that you pointed out. Some people call this episode Old Birdie, but actually the actual title of the episode, I believe, is The Thursday Man. It had to do with Mr. French. You and the character of Sissy had written a composition all about Mr. French. And your teacher was somewhat impressed, but not totally impressed. She said, well, that's all well and good, but I bet you don't really know Mr. French, do you? Your teacher suggested that maybe you should find out a little bit more about him, and you started snooping around.
That's right. Ronnie, I have to say that I know why you were a researcher for 15 years, because you are really a good researcher, and you want everything with all the facts as the best as you can research them, and I really applaud you for that. It's very rigorous.
Oh, well, thank you.
You know, that one really comes through with the actual happenstance or the actual facts of something without kind of glossing over it. Oh, we'll just accept that. And without it really being true. So thank you.
My pleasure. I didn't know where you were going with this, but thank you so much.
I want to
thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, I really appreciate that. But that's that's pretty much what the premise was. And the rest of the show involved you trying to find out about Mr. French. And there was something about Old Birdie. The Old Birdie was something that apparently years ago had gotten him very upset, if I recall.
Right.
We'll just play just a little bit of that particular episode, The Thursday Man.
Now that I think of it, I wonder if anybody really knows anything about other people. I mean, the real deep down insides of other people. The end.
I'd like to see you follow it up.
Follow it up?
I'm willing to give you extra credit for writing a sequel about Mr. French. I'd like to see you explore the possibility of getting to know someone.
Oh, gosh, it sort of scares me. Well, I mean, trying to get personal with Mr. French. Miss Elliot, if you knew him...
You won't do anything to hurt him or offend him. Now, perhaps he doesn't know how to reach you either. Perhaps he would welcome a chance to open up. You know, I've often thought that we all would.
Okay, Miss Elliot. I'll try. Mr. French.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you born?
London.
What part?
West End, of course.
What did your father do?
Oh, he was in service, as was my grandfather.
What was your mother like?
The matter of my family tree should be of small interest. Forgive me, Miss Sissy.
The reason that was called the Thursday Man, incidentally, is because...
Every Thursday, Sebastian would go someplace. And I said, where does he go every Thursday?
Well, actually, you call him Sebastian. You mean Mr. French. I mean, it's not Sebastian the actor. You probably even filmed some of these things on Thursdays, I assume. But actually, it was every Thursday, Mr. French would go somewhere. So, what's Mr. French doing on Thursdays? So,
right.
We got one more episode to play a little bit of. And this was not in the first season. This was maybe the second or third season. Waltz? What was the episode? I forgot the name of the episode.
Waltz from Vienna.
Oh, Waltz from Vienna. And the premise was pretty simple. You fell in love head over heels, or you thought you were in love. Tell me about this guy that you fell in love with as Sissy.
Well, he was a prince, and or almost a prince, from Austria. And I like it because I'm a quarter Austrian. I'm French, Irish, Swiss, and Austrian. And Vienna is one of the most romantic places in the world. I'm a romantic at heart. So I loved the whole premise of this thing. Everything was absolutely beautiful. It was elegant. I wore long dresses. He was very cute. And that's one of the reasons this is one of my favorite episodes.
Uh-huh. But in the end, you came to your senses.
Stupid me. I mean, how sensical was that?
Oh, I don't know. Actually, maybe you might have lived happily ever after with this prince.
Well, it's true, but then I would have only been in 30 episodes.
Oh, that's true. You couldn't. That's where people probably figured out, before getting to the end of the episode, that you weren't going to marry this guy.
Right.
Because they figure, are we going to jettison Sissy from the show?
They can't do that. We like her.
When Brian Keith, in the role of Uncle Bill, heard about your plans, he was decidedly, absolutely, positively against them.
I was too young.
Young and foolish.
Too young, yes, young and foolish. Too young to know my own heart.
Oh, Carl, I've had such a marvelous time these last 3 months. You've taken me to all the greatest places. Remember, the 21 Club, the Persian Room, the Four Seasons, the Colony.
Will there be anything else, sir?
Yes, perhaps a liqueur. Shall we say condiment?
I'm sorry, sir. May I see your ID cards?
I beg your pardon.
How old is the young lady, sir?
Make it an ice cream parfait.
Yes, miss.
I'm sorry. I find it hard to believe that a young lady of your age is treated like a child.
It's the law. They can't serve anyone under 18. Carl, I don't want you to leave.
Nick, now that we have found each other, would it not be absurd to part, to be thousands of miles away from each other, perhaps never to meet again?
What can we do about it?
Sissy, marry me. Live in Vienna.
Carl, really?
Yes, my mother and father approve of you. Please, Sissy.
Oh, yes.
And that was another wonderful episode of Family Affair. There is a box set that has every episode ever.
That's right, and then I do bonus features for each one of the seasons.
I thought you were going to say for each one of the episodes you do a bonus feature. That would be a little bit much.
Well, you know, there are some that have commentary for each one of the episodes, but MPI, who put out the DVD, didn't like that.
I see.
They say it was too interruptive.
But this is available. A DVD with all the seasons. Do they have separate DVDs for the individual seasons?
I think you can get those as well, yes.
Before we conclude the show by focusing on the principals, I want to ask you about Nancy Walker. I know Nancy Walker from the Quicker Picker Upper, the Bounty commercials.
Mm-hmm.
She also, I believe, was in Do-Re-Mi with Phil Silvers.
She played Rhoda's mother
on the Mary Tyler Moore spinoff. And what do you remember about her?
Oh, it was so different. She was used to a totally different kind of humor and comedy than was Family Affair. So she had a little bit of trouble adjusting because she was quick. And we were slow. Long, slow close-ups. And here she's ready to put in her quip. And, you know, we're still on the close-up. But she was a lovely woman. She was, you know, more of a New York personality and that type and much quicker pace.
Any discussion of Family Affair would not be complete if I didn't ask you, and of course, there's sadness with at least three of these. There's real sadness. First of all, you worked very closely with Brian Keith.
Brian, I had first met on the set of The Crusader, which was a TV series that he did, and I was just about 8 years old. So I had known him a long time. He was a very giving, generous person, but also very outspoken. And if he didn't like somebody, or if he didn't like an actor, he would tell them. And he would tell them on the set. But he loved kids, and he was such a fabulous actor. He abhorred publicity. He could have been the biggest star that ever was because he was such a good actor. But he did not like publicity. He just liked the work. And he had a very interesting approach to the work, very naturalistic. He would get the script and he says, okay, let me read it. Okay, let's go. And he would act from his emotions and what he felt as opposed to Sebastian Cabot, who had a different style. After Family Affair, of course, he went on and did Hardcastle and McCormick and other wonderful movies. Then there were some tragedies in his life, and he lost his daughter, and previously he had lost a son. And so, being an Irishman and being prone a little bit to depression, unfortunately, one fine day, you know, like Thomas Corey, Brian Keith went and put a bullet in his head.
Yeah, he was sick, too. He had some illness, personal illnesses, too, didn't he?
Yes, and he had been given that he only had 2 weeks to live.
So.
His doctor had told him that he was suffering, and he was Catholic. He made his peace with the priest. And I think even the priest was knowledgeable, you know, that he was depressed, but he was dying. Yeah,
it's
I mean, he had always been in charge of his own life, so he was going to be in charge of his own death.
He took control. Anissa Jones, she played the role of Buffy. Recollections of her?
Absolutely adorable, smart, giving, generous little child. She, unfortunately, had a stage mother that gave really a bad name to stage mothers. Anissa herself was just as sweet as she could be and very smart. But you have to understand that Anissa was almost 9 years old when the series began, and she was 14 when the series ended. And as I said earlier in our interview, she never changed. She still had the short dresses and the hair and the pigtails and carrying around this Mrs. Beasley doll.
Right.
Well, when you do that to a 13 or 14-year-old, they're starting to rebel, and they're not crazy about carrying around a little doll when they want to start being a teenager. You know, and hanging out. And so when the series ended, Anissa was even offered the role of the girl in The Exorcist.
The Linda Blair role?
Blair role,
yeah.
Reagan, I think it was her name. And she said, no, I'm done with show business. I don't want to do any more show business.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when she was 18 and she got her money that was put away for her, unfortunately she got into a wrong crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And at a party, they had all these different kinds of drugs.
Oh, gee.
PCP and this and that. She was very tiny. She was only 4'10", and her little body just couldn't take all those drugs.
And she died of a massive drug overdose.
It was the largest ever recorded in San Diego County history.
Cool.
So that was a real tragedy because she was so darling. And that's why, you know, Paul Peterson's a big friend of mine.
Yes.
And he has this organization called A Minor Consideration. We really try and help these kids child actors.
Sebastian Cabot played Mr. French. And what do you recall about Sebastian?
Very proficient actor, excellent actor, very serious, as opposed to Brian, who would say, okay, what do we have today? Sebastian would take his lines. Over the weekend, he would get it letter perfect, word for word. He would come in very prepared. He would study his lines on the set. And he was really wonderful that way. And I think, again, it made a fabulous contrast to Brian, the two gentlemen on the series, and again, kept that tension and kept that difference.
That's why it worked.
That was always so very interesting. He was very much a family man.
He was married for a long time, and they had two daughters and a son, and Annette Cabot was on the show in a couple episodes. But, you know, I'll tell you, Ronnie, what made this show be a classic and be such a wonderful show, I think, are really the personalities of the five main characters. Each one of us, very loving, very generous, very giving, and able to relate on a very emotional level of that level. Except for Nisa, but she still had that love and light,
right.
Very family-oriented.
As for Sebastian, he passed away 59 years old?
Yes, way too young.
And he died of a stroke?
Yes.
Finally, the character of Jody was played by Johnny Whitaker, who happily is still around. And
yes, he unfortunately had, you know, I think there were a couple articles. What, is there a curse on this family?
I don't know. You seem to be relatively normal, but it seems that the others just had tragedies and everything. But
yes,
your life seems to have been relatively normal, and obviously.
You can't see my tick.
Oh, no. No, I can't. I can't. Johnny Whitaker, recollections of Johnny working on the show with Johnny.
He was very cute. He was the youngest. Now, Johnny was only 6 and Anissa was 9.
And they were supposed to be twins.
And they were supposed to be twins. It's because Anissa was very little.
Yes.
And so they, if you see in the later episodes, Johnny has then surpassed her in height. He was very cute and adorable, and because he was younger, they had to work with him a little bit more in his lines. And
right.
Then I think he finally got rid of his little lisp, but a very, very cute little boy.
Oh.
But he got onto drugs, too. And became homeless and almost penniless. Then his family finally did an intervention and said, look, if you don't get off drugs, we're divorcing you as a family. And it was a very strong Mormon family. So that kind of brought him to his senses, and now he will happily tell you that he's been clean and sober for like 7 or 8 years. So that's good.
Is the cookbook still out as a cookbook? It's out both as a cookbook and as a CD? Is that the idea?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you can get the CD on audible.com.
Okay.
Or listenandlive.com.
Okay.
And then the cookbook is at my website that
okay.
you mentioned, kathygarver.com, or it's on amazon.com.
We're talking about the Family Affair cookbook, and it has some wonderful, wonderful recipes. And these are recipes which, for the most part, were actually served during the show.
That's right. The whole first part of the book.
Oh, my gosh. Antipasto, charlotte russe, beef wellington with pâté, and Uncle Bill's Eggs Benedict. I think that's the first one. There's 98 tracks on the CD, and almost all of them are recipes.
That's right.
So,
and, you know, I give a little about how the show was.
Primarily at the beginning and at the end,
right.
You basically tell some of what we've discussed here, but this is, of course, on a more personal level because you're telling me. And, yes, the show was funny. It was a sitcom, but it was also kind of a drama as well. It was very real. The characters were not slapstick. They were real characters. They were not caricatures, so to speak.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
And the show is beloved after all these years. People just love the show. Kathy, do you still do appearances?
Oh, yes. I do autograph shows and take my books, etc. I love to do that and go out and meet my fans. And I teach, and I try and keep my 19-year-old still going to college.
All right. Is he in show business?
No, he's not.
Oh, okay.
No, he's an entrepreneur so
okay.
far.
We could have an autograph show right here in my house.
Okay.
And I'm going to fly you out here tomorrow, and we'll invite all my friends and everybody else that wants to come, and we'll talk all about Family Affair. Kathy, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to do this. This is so special. Your show is so special, and I want to wish you continued health, happiness, and success in whatever you do. I wish you everything that you wish yourself.
Thank you, Ronnie. Same to you. I've enjoyed it very much.
That concludes this interview, and we're going to close with, why not, the Family Affair theme. And that's the show, folks.
We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers the 50s and 60s.